Throughout the Second World War, the Nazis created a slew of unorthodox weapons, some of which saw battlefield action, and some of which never made it out of the concept stage. Some of these weapons were truly terrifying, utilizing technology that very few people had seen before.
TheCollector.com. Article published March 22, 2025.
Welcome to the Oddity Archive with Evan and David.
I got mine recording. Let's talk about some Nazis.
Timely.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. All right. I'm rolling. Ready when you are.
And welcome back.
Heyo.
Evan, how you doing?
Overall, I'm good. I had a work trip and came back to a partially flooded home, but it could have been a lot worse. And we're just going to have some giant dehumidifiers running around the clock, but we're back on the path to being all fixed up and good to go.
That's the humming that we'll hear in the background.
Yeah, so if you hear some gentle machinery in the background, it's me drying out my house.
It doesn't happen to be a secret Nazi weapon that you have stored at your house, does it?
Not that I would know about, but as we cut out all the drywall, I'll see what I find in there.
All right. You know, it could be today's topic, the Nazi bell. We don't know where it is anymore. Season finale, at least that's what we're calling it. We kind of arbitrarily picked 10 episodes for the season.
Seemed like a good round number to cap it off.
How do you feel like it's gone?
Honestly, surprisingly well. Not to self-congratulate, but I definitely have some of my own personal high points. A few things just got a little more dialed up, a little more honed in. Jersey Devil felt like a good episode. I think that was a good jump. And then what was the last one we did? John Teeter. That one also felt like a good step ahead.
Yeah, so, John Teeter.
Yeah, I feel like we've got some in here. It's been fun. And that was always the main goal for me is just if this isn't fun, then we're not doing it right. And it's been fun the whole way. So
yeah, I agree. I think if you go back and listen to episode one now, it does sound a bit different from how we sound now.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the listeners didn't know when they listened to episode one, but that was the first in-person conversation that we had had in over a decade.
Yeah.
And so I think just kind of connecting back together with each other, we've gotten more comfortable. I think now we're a little bit looser. We can kind of play off of each other's jokes a little bit more. We've kind of fallen back into a friendship that we talked about, you know, we used to have.
For sure.
And I think that's come through in the episodes. I think they've gotten a little more fun to listen to as we've gone through the season.
We're back, baby.
Yeah. And I think just podcast-wise, I had seen some of the things that you had worked on in the past, but coming to you with a vision and entrusting you to edit everything, there is some inherent sort of fear that, well, what if I like ask Evan to do this and he just butchers it?
What if he's terrible, you know, at his job? You know,
what if this podcast doesn't turn out to be anything like I want it to be? And that went away really quickly. I think the first edit you ever made of this podcast, mm-hmm. and I had got up the next morning because you edit at like 3 a.m. and I'll wake up to like, hey, here's the latest edit. And it was sent 2 hours ago. And I'm like, okay. But you sent me that first 20 minutes. And so I popped it in my headphones and I was like, all right, let's see how this is going to go. Mm-hmm. And I was just shocked at how good the first 20 minutes of the first episode was. And I was like, if this is our starting point,
yeah,
then I think we got something here.
Like, honestly, it was fun to help you kind of realize this thing you've had in your head for a while, because it was me trying to kind of read your mind a little bit, but also you deserve some credit. Like, I mean, I'll take all the editing love that you want to throw my way, but you also just brought me like something far more fully realized. I thought like, well, we'll stumble through. We might not even release the first one. And then as I started cutting, I was like, no, this is all sounding pretty good to me. Let's go ahead and let this thing fly. I hope, fair to say, a good collaboration between the two of us and our strengths.
Yeah, definitely. And so it's kind of a look back, looking forward.
Yeah.
For everybody out there listening, this is a season finale. And so after this one releases, we're going to have two bonus episodes. So 2 weeks from today, we'll have bonus episode one. And 2 weeks from then, we'll have bonus episode two.
To set up expectation a little bit, a little more laid back, lower on research, and less of an edit lift for me, but hopefully still engaging for people tuning in Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. And then after that, we'll be back with season 2, episode 1. And then the last thing I want to talk about, last week I kind of teased a giveaway.
Yeah.
I'm not going to give it away right now. But at the end of this episode, I will reveal the giveaway, what it is, how to sign up for it, when the winner will be announced, etc., etc. So listen through before we roll the end credits. We'll go over all the details of that.
It's a pretty sick giveaway, if I do say so myself.
So that being said, are you ready to teleport to Nazi Germany?
Is that a good place to go? Yeah, I'm in your hands, so I trust that you're taking me to somewhere I'll be safe in that regard.
So I guess we should start as we always do. Have you ever heard of the Nazi bell?
So I feel like, in the interest of full disclosure, normally I do come in more or less 100% blind unless I just happen to know about the topic. This one, for reasons I don't want to go into quite yet, I did get a little bit of background information on it, but it's still a little murky to me. So I'm looking forward to hearing more from you about it so I can kind of get a little clarity on what exactly it was, because it was a little confusing to me at first glance.
Okay.
Is that a reasonable first take on it?
Yeah, that makes sense. And I know where you're coming from. The listeners will by the end of this.
Yeah.
In researching this topic, the research took a turn that I was not expecting whatsoever.
Good, bad, or something in between?
Oh, it was beyond my wildest dreams.
Okay. Looking forward to that then.
Yeah. And so really, we got to start off.
David hung up on me, so I guess I'll just take over. The Nazi bell.
Oh, there we go.
Oh, okay. He's back. Okay.
Oh, I'm back.
Don't tell him what I said.
Oh. So, to start off talking about the Nazi bell,
yeah,
we really just have to do sort of a brief history of Nazi Germany.
Yeah, seems like a good starting point.
And the Nazi bell was potentially a weapon that was being developed by the Nazis. But in order to understand why, how this could even be possible, mm-hmm. we sort of have to talk about the time period in Germany that all of this was going on.
Right.
And so the war starts 1939. Sometime in 1942, Hitler starts a program to develop what's called the Wunderwaffen. A lot of German words. They're not getting pronounced correctly.
Well, you're a Stuhldreher. I mean, you gotta.
Well.
You got to bring a little bit.
Well, I'll try my best. But as with most of the foreign words, they're not going to turn out well. The only way I passed any foreign language in high school was pure, unadulterated cheating.
I was going to say the exact. I was like, the only reason I passed Spanish War was because I was sitting next to Ben. So thanks, Ben.
But so they start developing or putting resources into the Wunderwaffen,
Okay. Which
it basically is wonder weapons. And this was an attempt by Hitler to create these weapons that would destroy their enemy. It was beyond anything that anybody had ever seen before. Mm-hmm. It was brand new technology type of stuff. Some of this was the propaganda machine at work.
Right.
So the German people would believe our government is creating these incredible things and they're extremely powerful and they can defeat our enemies and everything. But there was a good amount of this that actually did get developed.
Okay. So it's kind of like their R&D department.
Yeah.
But also just because they kind of show the public and be like, look how amazing and mighty we are.
Exactly. Yeah. And so some examples of things that were under the Wonder Weapon program that did get developed, they had the Panther tank, which was one of their more powerful tanks. Mm-hmm. They had a prototype submarine, the XX-1 that they developed. The Fritz X, if you want to call back to the Larry Bader episode.
They should have called it the Bader.
the Bader X.
Everybody get down. The Bader's coming. Sorry, we'll retire that.
So the Fritz X, it was actually one of the first ever precision-guided weapons deployed in combat. So a lot of this stuff was like state-of-the-art weaponry that they were developing. You may have heard of the V rockets
that the Germans produced. Mm-hmm. That was out of the Wunderwaffen program. They're developing a lot of these new state-of-the-art weapons. And the people running this side of things, the Wunderwaffen program, they're some of the top scientists and engineers in the entire world. The most famous of them is Wernher von Braun. Mm-hmm. He developed the V2 rocket. He also is one of the major reasons that America won the space race to the moon.
Oh, he defected?
No, he didn't defect, because after the war, through Operation Paperclip, the United States said, hey, if you're smart enough, we don't care that you were a Nazi.
Oh.
Come help us get to the moon. There was a huge sort of battle. It wasn't like people shooting at each other battle, but between the Russians and the United States to get the best minds out of Nazi Germany. And the program for that in America was called Operation Paperclip. And they got like over 1,000 Nazi scientists to the United States.
Was there no vetting? No.
No.
So it's not like, oh, hey, I didn't actually want to be part of that regime.
No, it was, you're going to come work for us now.
All right, come on over. You're smart enough to help us get to the moon.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
It was, we want to beat the Russians to the moon. You're the best rocket scientists in the world. Don't care about your Nazi connections. Come work for NASA.
Yeah.
And I sent you a picture of him.
Yeah.
His like official NASA portrait standing in front of a bunch of rockets. So the Wunderwaffen program can be looked at as this sort of pie in the sky, trying to get these conceptualized super weapons made. But there were a good number of them that actually came to fruition. And there were very brilliant minds working behind them.
Was everybody on that team German, or did they ever go steal people from other countries?
The people working on the Wunderwaffen program, they were in the Nazi party. They were trying to continue the cause. They did use, for like the construction of the facilities and some of the manufacturing processes, they used slave labor. But the engineers, the rocket scientists, all of those were in the Nazi party.
Okay.
And so the program starts about 1942, and then the war starts to take a turn.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Stalingrad ending February 2nd, 1943. That sort of is as far as the Nazis got into Russia. And then D-Day happening June 6th, 1944.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of the beginning of the end on the Western Front. And so the writing's kind of on the wall that the Nazis are going to be defeated.
Yeah.
And Hitler at this point starts getting a fair bit delusional. He starts coming up with these concepts, these ideas of things that can win the war.
Mm-hmm.
That if we just create this one thing, we will fight everybody back and we will take over and we'll win the war.
Yeah.
And a lot of it was stuff that just simply is not possible.
Knowing what I know about him, I don't think accepting defeat was ever going to be on the table.
Yeah. Even in his very last days, he was telling the people around him that there were regiments of 10,000 troops that were coming from the north to liberate Berlin and take back Germany. And none of those people existed. Like those units didn't exist.
Where he's like, we have the Wunderwaffens. Trust me. We have Wunderwaffens.
Yeah. And so his sort of orders to manufacturers started getting a little off the wall,
mm-hmm.
let's say.
Yeah.
And so some of the Wunderwaffen that he started to develop at this point, or asked to be developed.
Oh, so he was still pushing that program even as things were taking a turn.
He actually started pushing it even more.
He's looking for like a silver bullet to suddenly turn things around.
Exactly. He sort of maybe in the back of his mind realized, I'm going to lose. And so he started pushing, I just need that one thing that's going to make a comeback and win the war for me.
Right, right.
And so some of the things that he started pouring money and resources into, because these weren't just rantings that he would make to his generals. He would actually order the development of these things.
Was there hesitancy for the people assigned this to carry it out? Or was it, hey, he's asking, let's just try it, I guess.
I think kind of both.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was, well, he's putting all these resources towards us. Let's see what we can come up with this. But I feel like in the back of their minds, they kind of know it's over.
Yeah.
But some of the things that he started ordering to get developed at this point were things like a ballistic missile submarine, which we have now, right? We have a submarine that can launch a nuclear weapon
right.
back in the 1940s that didn't exist. But he was ordering, I want a submarine that can launch ballistic missiles.
They didn't have a nuclear weapon even as a baseline. So
no, they didn't. That was another program. All of the superpowers at that point were working on the atom bomb.
They don't even have the nuclear bomb yet. And he's like, okay, so not only that, I also need it to be shot from the ocean. And they'd be like, what?
Yeah. He ordered a 115-foot long, 36-foot tall, 1,000-ton tank to be built.
Give me those dimensions again.
115 feet long, 36 feet tall.
Yeah.
And it allegedly would have weighed around 1,000 tons. So he poured a lot of resources. He started kind of getting a little bit obsessed with the idea of bombing the United States because he saw U.S. bombers destroying German towns. And so he contacted a bunch of airplane manufacturers and said, I want a bomber that can fly to the United States and back and tear down their cities, which with 2 years left in the war, of course, he didn't know that.
Right.
But with the sides closing in on him, you just don't have the resources to develop a brand new aircraft that has triple the range of the longest range aircraft at the time.
Yeah, right.
And then one of the wildest concepts, he poured resources into a sun gun, which would have been a massive orbiting mirror.
Oh,
that could concentrate sunlight to a specific point on the Earth.
I thought it was just going to be like a bright light they created, not so much, you know, a magnifying glass in space to burn places.
Yes. There is actual evidence that he was ordering the manufacturing of essentially an orbiting magnifying glass to burn humans like we burn ants with them.
I mean, the thing is, I understand just R&D, hey, see what's possible, but it sounds like he's saying, no, go make me this thing versus see if this is possible.
Yeah, he's basically ordering, I need this weapon made so that we will win the war.
I'm picturing a room of 20 scientists and he comes, he's like, all right, we're going to make the sun gun. And then they all look at each other. And they're like, what do we tell him?
That's probably not inaccurate.
I feel like you just say yes and then try and, you know, drag it out so you're not removed from the planet.
Yeah, you're not going to be like, that's insane, we can't do that. You're going to be like, oh yeah, absolutely, we'll get working on that right away.
Yeah, it'll take a few years, we'll let you know.
Right. And so the next thing is what this episode is about, the Nazi bell.
Right.
And so just some general information about the bell. It's shaped like, you guessed it, a bell. It's about 12 feet high. And it's 9 feet in diameter.
Smaller than the tank blueprints.
Yeah, a little bit smaller than the tank blueprints. The Bell, or in German, Die Glock. This is a weapon that is pretty controversial on whether it actually existed, whether it was ever actually planned, what it did, how it did what it was supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And so we'll jump into all of that stuff.
Well, I mean, already from the other ones you described, this thing must be a little wild.
Yeah. And so the Nazi bell, just some, I can't even say facts, because we don't know if this thing ever existed. We don't even actually know if this thing was ever planned. Mm-hmm. We'll sort of dig into that. And that's going to sort of be the question at the end of the episode is, was the Nazi bell ever real?
Okay.
And so we'll get to that. But it was alleged to be, like I said, a bell, 12 feet high, 9 feet in diameter. And on the inside, it had two high-speed counter-rotating cylinders filled with a purplish liquid metallic-looking substance that was supposed to be highly radioactive.
So I'm going to ask a dumb question here.
Yeah.
I assume this thing doesn't ring.
It does not ring. Okay. It got the name solely because of its shape. So most people first heard about the bell from the 2001 book, The Hunt for Zero Point by Nick Cook.
Okay. This is a nonfiction work, I assume?
Yeah, a nonfiction work. I don't know anything about zero point energy. I can't give you any details about that. I just know that's what the book was about.
Okay.
And he mentions the Nazi bell in his book.
Does he talk about it like it's fact,
Yes.
Okay.
He talks about it as factual, and there's a tremendous amount of energy that the bell would develop. And so there's some connection between that and zero point energy.
Okay.
Again, I don't know what that connection is. But so he mentions the bell, and this is the first time a lot of people hear about it. And so people go to him and they're like, where did this come from? Mm-hmm. You're just suddenly devolving this Nazi super weapon. Yeah. Where'd you come up with that idea?
When did this book come out? Do you know?
2001.
Oh, so this is relatively recent.
Yeah, relatively recent. And so people go to him, they're like, what's going on? Where did this concept of this thing come from? And he points to a Polish book that was released in the year 2000, Prawda o Wunderwaffen, or translated, The Truth About the Wonder Weapon.
Okay.
And this is a book written by Igor Witkowski. And this is the first written record of the Nazi bell ever existing. This is a nonfiction work by Igor. This is well after the war. He was researching some things about Nazis, about the Wunderwaffen, and a Polish special agent came to him and disclosed some documents to him that showed the plans and some testing results of the bell.
Okay.
And so he wrote about it in his book, The Wunderwaffen.
And his background is author?
He's an author, a researcher, journalist.
Gotcha.
So some background about the bell.
Yeah.
He said that it was developed in a facility near the Wenceslaus mine, specifically in a facility built into the mine called De Reis. And they used a structure. This is the third picture that I sent you. They used a concrete structure there called the henge to test the bell. And that the bell was some sort of anti-gravitational device.
Okay. Sun gun's looking a little more normal now.
Sun gun's looking a little more normal, right?
Yeah.
And so the Nazi bell was some sort of anti-gravitational device. And so they would strap it to the hinge so that it wouldn't just fly away.
So the concrete's to weigh it down or keep it in place?
They would like chain it to the hinge and turn it on and see if it would levitate or move or get off the ground in any sort of way.
Was the hope that it would lift the concrete block or to contain it?
The concrete block or structure was hopefully going to keep it in place.
Oh, so it was like around it. So it wouldn't just like,
yeah,
hey, we made it. And then it just goes to space. Oh, wait, my Wunderweapon.
Exactly. And so this is the point that the research for this case took a wild turn that I was not expecting.
Okay.
Because I reached out. And Igor Witkowski, the person who broke this story to the world, agreed to an interview.
The author of the book that you mentioned as the origin point for this information.
Yeah, the origin of the Nazi bell information. Igor Witkowski agreed to an interview with me.
What did you have to do to make such things happen? I am afraid to ask.
I'm not going to reveal my secrets on that
one. Yeah, that's fair.
So now the second half of this episode is going to be the interview with him. Mm-hmm. And we'll kind of go question by question and we'll cut in between the questions and react and sort of process what's going on, what we heard, all that stuff. Because as I was researching this, it all seems very out there. And so in my mind, I was thinking, let's go to the source and get as much information as we can. Because I could just sit here with you and talk about this anti-gravitational device that the Nazis were developing and testing and all sorts of information about it. And you're going to look at me like I'm an idiot. Like, it is just kind of an outrageous device.
Yeah.
And so I figured, well, let's hear it from the source. So the first thing that I asked him was to just give some information about the bell and maybe why he thought the Polish agent came to him with the information.
Okay.
So let's jump into that. And then after we hear from Igor, we'll come back and react to it.
All right, we'll roll that now.
Hi.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Just a moment, I have to adjust the sound. Yeah, okay.
Are we good?
Yep.
First of all, just thank you for taking some time out of your day to chat with me. I really appreciate it.
Not a problem.
The first question that I have in reading up about the bell, I was curious to know what you think it was about you and your research and your work that had the Polish agent come to you and disclose the information about the bell.
I'm not sure. My impression was that it was a part of something, not a ready weapon or a flying machine or anything like that. And it was, you know, for obvious reasons, it was difficult for me to comprehend it in the first place. And then try to imagine the part of what it might have been. And I suspect, I may only share my suspicion about mm-hmm. It was, you know, because for me, the relativistic context or analogies, I mean, the physical terms or ideas relating to, in my view, to relativistic physics, I mean, the theory of relativity, were obvious. And I consulted various scientists. I know some people, and they generally shared this opinion with me. And so I was pretty, I mean, convinced that it was most likely explanation for me, that it was something related to the to relativistic physics. It might have been gravity. It might have been some kind of a manipulation with time or something like that. I wasn't sure of that. But later on, after some years, because this research took a lot of time, a friend of mine, a US researcher, I don't remember his name, just a moment, Henry Stevens, sorry, I had to look at his book.
Yeah.
He got to the documents in the NARA archive, which is a federal archive near Washington in the United States. He has found a pretty extensive description of what they were doing, and it was a testimony of former German scientist Ronald Richter, which found its way to the U.S. military after the war. It was a long, complex story, but nevertheless, there was in this document, it was clearly mentioned that what they were doing with the plasma physics, with spinning of, plasma high. Heavy ions and so on, with in very strong magnetic fields, that it was the purpose of it was to build a kind of a propulsion system, built referring to plasma physics and nuclear physics, in order to, as it was. It is my free quotation. I not remember exact sentence, but the sense was such that it was clearly mentioned that the aim of it was to manipulate gravity, which control gravity, and so that's how it ended, and one may see it as a kind of a confirmation that it was related to a propulsion system, but the general hull of which it was part, I mean the bell, is still unclear, and I may only imagine this. There was a kind of a strange publication in the. I don't remember if it was in the late 60s or early 70s on a technological fair in Germany. German city. I don't remember the name of this fair. There appeared a guy who was handing over a kind of first issue of something that looked like a magazine. It was titled Brisant. Eventually, nothing else has been published under this title. It was only one issue handed over, not sold anywhere, handed over to the people at this technological fair, where there were many, drawings, blueprints of such a flying craft, and allegedly from the time of the war, but it's not verifiable because the source of it remains unknown of these plans. But on one of these blueprints, there was something that pretty much resembled the bell. External appearance of it. And underneath of it, it was placed in the center of some kind of discoidal flying machine. And underneath of what appeared like a bell, there was something larger, some structure, something like a spiral structure or something like that, which would confirm that the bell was a kind of a core of some larger system. But I'm mentioning it only as a curiosity because, as I mentioned, it cannot be verified.
Okay, so a lot to unpack there.
Yeah.
Do you want to give your initial thoughts? Because you're a little more up to speed on this than me, and then I can kind of chime in and give any thoughts that maybe came to mind as I was listening.
My initial reaction to his answer there was that he himself seems a little skeptical of the bell. Mm-hmm. He's not just right off, yeah, it was real. This is what it did. This is how it was developed. He is very open about this is speculation. I can't verify certain things. These are just my best guesses based on what I saw in the documents that were presented to me.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't just immediately come off as a conspiracy theorist or something. Like he seems to actually know what he's talking about.
Yeah. No, I would agree. Just the tone he's speaking with, it all sounds very honest. I mean, do you have any reason to doubt anything that he would publish or say to you in an interview?
No. I mean, he did this interview for free. He didn't ask for any sort of money. He didn't ask for any sort of mention or anything.
And we're not exactly, a giant conglomerate that can spread his story around or anything like that.
Yeah. And so, he got nothing out of doing this interview. So in that regard, I have no reason to doubt the things that he's saying.
Yeah. Just based on, what I've heard, it sounds like he's coming from an honest place.
Yeah. And it sounds like, to get back to the bell.
Yeah.
His take on it is that it was some sort of anti-gravitational device,
mm-hmm.
and that specifically it was a propulsion system. It was a motor or an engine, if you will,
yeah,
for some larger type of thing.
That was the spiral he was mentioning was underneath it, right?
Yeah, the blueprints that he saw that had a bell inside of a larger structure. We talked about earlier, one of the things we know Hitler was trying to develop was a plane, an aircraft,
mm-hmm.
that could fly to the United States and all the way back. If you had some sort of anti-gravitational device, that could probably take care of it.
If he's got like sun guns and all this other crazy stuff going, I'm wondering how wild his imagination is getting with whatever this thing is supposed to do.
Yeah, he could have been ordering some wild stuff.
And I want to make sure I'm connecting the dots correctly. It sounded like Igor was saying he got blueprints from somewhere and was making his conclusions based on what he saw there. But also there was a single issue of a magazine, Brisant?
Mm-hmm.
That's also where there was a picture of it over the spiral and then underneath it or something in the description just said flying machine or something to that effect.
Yeah, I think you have it correct. So he was given documents from this Polish agent that were blueprints, plans, maybe testing results. We don't really know exactly what was on those documents because we didn't see them.
Yeah.
Other than that, he saw this issue of this magazine that was released that had blueprints, but they were for some sort of flying machine, mm-hmm. and it looked like the Bell was within the flying machine.
And I assume based on seeing the blueprints and that, he was able to basically, like we're doing, connect the dots and be like, oh, this is that thing that I have deeper knowledge on.
Yeah. And so it was allegedly within the Wunderwaffen program, Wonder Weapon, but technically the Bell, according to Igor, wouldn't be classified as a weapon. You couldn't just like turn it on and kill people. Mm-hmm. It was more a propulsion system to move weaponry or aircraft around.
That's where, man, I want to know what that spiral thing was in the magazine. Just that seems like the other part.
And he said more than once that the blueprints with the spiral and the aircraft and all that, that came out of this magazine. There's no way to verify the authenticity of anything like that. It was just something that he happened upon,
yeah.
and kind of made the connection to the Bell. So that's entirely theoretical in and of itself too.
Also, I thought it was interesting. He's like, oh, I also talked to somebody in the US military who said, oh yeah, we actually have reference to that too.
I don't know if it was US military personnel, but someone in the United States said something to the effect of, yeah, that's what this is for.
Corroborating his, like, we've heard about this too.
Exactly.
Poland and the US and this magazine, that's three very different places for this information to come from.
Yeah, this kind of went right into my next question for him, because so far, you know, he's talked about blueprints and stuff like that. And so I asked him, you know, how far along did the Nazis get in actually developing this device? Mm-hmm. Was it all just paperwork, or did they actually create a Bell and test it?
Yeah.
And so we can listen to his response now.
Yeah, let's go ahead and get into that one.
And then I guess that leads into my next question is, do we have any idea how far along they got in developing this? Did they build a physical Bell? Was it all just theoretical, or did they actually construct something and test it?
There was no mention of anything larger than the Bell. I mean, in the sources to which I had access. From the testimony, it's based entirely on the testimony of one SS officer who was responsible for the evacuations of this team and its hardware at the end of the war in the April of 1945, and from what he knew, it appears that their main concern until the very end, and until early 1945, was to limit the harmful effects that the Bell generated, the harmful radiation, which killed all the organisms in the vicinity, and so on. And I suspect that it might result from the ions of the mercury being spinned, colliding with the disk in which it was spinning. So therefore, it might result from the I don't know how to say it. irregularities in the geometry of the magnetic field controlling this vortex, for example, which allowed some collisions with the electrodes or with the structure of the Bell, because such ions would have to move with very high speeds, and any collision would create some kind of radiation, neutrons included. So about February or March 1945, it was mentioned in this testimony of this prisoner of war, Rudolf Schuster, if I remember correctly, that they managed to overcome this obstacle And in other one may say, therefore, that they perfected the design, but that's all that I know about the, I mean, stage at which it ended. I have no, I mean, no reliable information suggesting that it was something flying, for example, something ready. But it seems from, in my opinion, that it was very close to the to mastering, or I don't know how to say it, but that in other words, that the laboratory or technical phase was ended or close to be ending, but it was there is nothing that would suggest that that there was any commencing of some industrial phase or something like that.
All right, so that was a pretty interesting answer from him on that one, because he's proposing that a bell was constructed.
Yeah.
It was tested. There were issues with it, with the radiation, and those issues were taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of the war, they had a fully functional bell.
That was my take also. Yeah.
I was not expecting that answer from him.
But then it sounded like he said they wrapped out the laboratory part, but there was no sign that they were ever going to start manufacturing one.
Yeah, so my take on that was that they did make a bell, and they tested it, and they worked out all the kinks of it, but they were never able to use it as a propulsion system.
Hmm.
Like, they were never able to get it into a flying machine or a rocket or what have you.
Or maybe just it doesn't scale. Like, they made one and they're like, this takes so much resource. Making one was as good as it was going to get, maybe something like that.
Yeah. And time running out, he said, I think February, March 1945. So you're within 4 months of the war ending. There just wasn't time for them to go any further with it.
And like you said, they're bleeding resources at this point. They're making up soldiers that don't exist. So
yeah,
they might not be able to be like, all right, so we'll make a second bell. Is that a great idea? Or
let's make a second bell and let's make a giant aircraft to put it in. Yeah. And then, yeah, you know, the plans are getting kind of convoluted at that point.
Right.
But so with him stating that a bell was physically made, my next question is, where is it? What happened to it? Has anybody ever seen this thing? I'll just kind of pre-discuss the answer to this question. When I asked him, where is the bell? What happened to it?
Mm-hmm.
The answer that he gave me was not at all what I was expecting to hear. So let's jump in and listen to that one.
Yeah, let's see what he says.
So it sounds like they were able to construct a bell and run some tests on it. Is there any evidence where that may have ended up after the war? Did they just destroy it as they did with many things? Or is there any theories about where it could be today?
I don't remember when it was. It was about 2010, 2011. I have been contacted surveilled, in fact, by a group of Germans with a link to Argentina. I mean, the oldest one of them was Argentine, and he was quite an old man. They started, you know, being interested in what I'm doing, and gathered information about me. And eventually, because for some reason they were afraid of how I may interpret this as a threat, for example, they started to shoot me in a way, so, and send me a message which suggested, and it was pretty convincing because. I would prefer not to repeat all this chain of events, but shortly speaking, I had some signal from Germans linked to Argentina which suggested to me, and it was pretty convincing for me because of the details contained, that they keep they guard it and keep it under their control, and that they expect that there will come a time when it all will be so-called revealed, I don't know how to say it, used, revealed, and they will, it would, in their view, be a part of a kind of a operation or something like that. I would like to not to go into details, not because I consider them secret, but because it's quite a complex story. But never, shortly speaking, as I mentioned, what I may say is that a signal from the Germans is was suggesting to me that they keep it, they have it. They have the know-how, at least.
Okay, so maybe not a physical bell, but they have the plans and the know-how to make another one, perhaps, in Argentina. At least they did, you know, 15 years ago when they were contacting you.
Yeah.
So that answer took a turn I was not expecting.
Yeah. Made me sweat a little.
So, given what he said, are you aware of the Nazi flight to Argentina, if you will?
No, I was really curious where that connection was coming from.
Okay, so a little bit of background on that is the Argentinian government was sort of kind of allies. They didn't really support the war in any way, but they supported Nazism. And so when the war ended, a lot of Nazis fled Germany to Argentina.
Okay.
And to this day, there are parts of Argentina that you can go to that if you teleported there, you would think you were in Germany. The architecture, everything looks like a German town.
Like a little Germany, if you will.
Yeah, like a little Germany in Argentina.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just grunts and soldiers that were fleeing. Some high-profile Nazis went to Argentina.
I feel like maybe even more prominent people, if you were able to get out, given the circumstances of the war kind of wrapping up,
yeah,
to get all the way to Argentina probably wouldn't be the easiest thing. So maybe it was even some of the more affluent ones, but it sounds like they were fascists that were going to a place where fascism was still welcome. So still kind of like home. Is that a fair comparison?
Yeah, like you said, some high profile Nazis made it to Argentina. A couple of the most infamous ones: Adolf Eichmann went there. He was the architect of the Holocaust. Joseph Mengele, he was dubbed the Angel of Death at Auschwitz. Both of them went to Argentina. It's been documented. They found pseudonyms, lived false lives.
Did they live out their remaining days there? Do we know?
Both of them, I believe, were eventually found and brought to trial.
Okay.
But they lived for quite a while in Argentina, just living their life down there.
Yeah. They should have come to NASA, it sounds like.
Evidently, they weren't smart enough. Yeah, right. So I was not expecting the conversation with Igor to go to Argentina.
Yeah.
But if plans for the Bell were going to end up anywhere, it probably would have been Argentina, just given, you know, where the Nazis fled to. Mm-hmm. I was expecting him to say they destroyed it, because the Nazis sort of famously went scorched earth and just destroyed as much as possible so that nobody could figure out what they were doing.
I feel like that's common with the military, too. If a helicopter goes down, a U.S. one somewhere overseas, we tend to blow it up so that no one gets a hand on top secret stuff we have or just our equipment, whatever it might be.
Yeah. So I was expecting a simple answer like, oh, they destroyed it. Instead, we got, no, some people in Argentina contacted me. They didn't want me digging too much. And so that answer took an interesting turn.
I just love how passively he says, people started monitoring me and reaching out.
Yeah, like, no big deal.
Yeah. And I think one of the most interesting things I took out of that, too, was that they're like, we're waiting for the right time to reveal this.
Yeah.
Could be read a lot of different ways, but in my head, it's that Argentina would be waiting for the right moment to bring back the Bell.
Yeah.
So when we see a giant flying spiral in the sky, Coming from the South, we'll know.
Yeah. The next thing I asked him about, because all of the stuff we've talked about has been verified through Nazi documentation. Even the Sun gun, there are Nazi verified documents that show at some point this was a thought. You know, they didn't really get into manufacturing a Sun gun, but they were thinking about it. They were conceptualizing that kind of thing.
We have weapons now that will make you feel super hot or use ultrasonics to make you sick. Those things, if they didn't come to exist, would you be like, you can't do that? Are you stupid? That's not the craziest thing for them to like look into, especially if you're on your back foot in a war and just trying to look for that silver bullet just to get you out of it.
Oh yeah. I asked him, because we know about all this other stuff, how top secret was this project? Because it seems like it's more top secret than anything else we've talked about.
The way he was talking about it, the radiation killing all the organisms in the area and stuff, sounded like it was an issue at first, and then they maybe that's why they built the Henge. Is that how you say it?
The Henge.
Henge.
Yeah, like Stonehenge.
To contain all that. So one of my initial thoughts was maybe that was some take on the atom bomb they were trying to come up with. I'm not going to be able to say it in scientific ways, but just atom science, we'll call it, went into the creation of the atom bomb. And a lot of the stuff being used in that kind of sounds similar to stuff that would be tapped for creating an atomic bomb.
So you're saying the technology used to create the bell could also be used to create a bomb.
Or that the bell was one fork of many approaches to create an atom bomb. Similar science sounds like it's going into it.
I gotcha.
And that's being said by a not very super scientific person, so that's the best I can do.
I gotcha.
But the gravity thing is, I guess, not as integral, unless the idea was, oh, we can just float this thing over to the U.S.,
Yeah.
But that's me drawing a lot of conclusions on my own. So do you need to set up the next question you had with Igor?
Yeah, so that was where I asked him, how top secret was this?
Oh, right, yes.
And so let's listen to his answer on that one, and we'll get back.
So I was reading or listening somewhere about the bell, and they were talking about, you know, just how top secret this was. And some places were saying that it was top secret, like above the nuclear program that they would have had going on end of World War II Germany. Does that line up with what you know about the Bell? Was this even more top secret than an atom bomb program?
You know, I studied science and technology during the Second World War and in Germany in particular, but what I have seen in this case, in the documents associated with to which I got access searching for information in this case, was very strange. I mean, I give you one short and simple example that I don't remember exactly when it was, but it was about 1942, I guess, or maybe 1943, that one of the, you know, there were many institutions or institutes involved in this research. And one of them was an research institute of the AEG consortium in Berlin. Which was responsible, for example, for a kind of a system powering the bell, which had its own code name and so on. And one of the scientists in this team has been arrested, alleged under, you know, a pretext that he undermined the official version of how the World War II started. That it was a comment after an air raid, and one of the other scientists denounced him to the Gestapo. And in this case, the institute and has issued a letter to the Gestapo, stating that he was crucial. A key scientist working in a project that is officially classified as they put it, decisive for the war, Kriegsentscheidend in German, and that he cannot be arrested. Obviously, the Gestapo has dropped the case, but there was a specific reference to a conference on which such a classification, kind of a classification, because it is, you know, this words decisive for the war. I read as a kind of stage of a classification, you know, of secrecy. Or a priority, because there was a system of priorities in Germany during the war, or in terms of access to raw materials or workforce and so on. And the strange thing was that this protocol, during which there was a such a term has been invented, took place long before. The whole idea could be checked and verified, because you know, initially it was a project run together with the Wehrmacht's research and development division, which was called Heereswaffenamt. And it was a joint project between the SS and the Wehrmacht. And there are some documents on this too. And already then, it was in 1941, I guess, under the code name Tor, which means a gate or gateway in German, it had such a priority or a classification above anything known so far. And it was very strange, because it nothing has been made physically yet then. So how could they know that it might have been decisive for the war if they if it appeared to me, for example, that they didn't really understand fully what was going on in such a vortex, in such a device. Because, you know, from the research in 1944, even, there were such a, when I read this interrogation protocol of this Rudolf Schuster, this prisoner of war, this SS officer, I had the impression that they didn't fully understand what was going on in this device. Mm-hmm. So the strange thing is that they, you know, when you grant such a kind of priority over above all other priorities, or a classification, I mean, so kind of a stage of secrecy above of anything known, you have to do it generally, usually, in a state waging war, with some justification, with some, you know, some background, some arguments, and so it seems to me like a kind of a reverse engineering that from some other you know direction, so to speak, they might know that it was something breakthrough, but. It's quite strange, you know. I have never seen any such a case before.
A lot to kind of work through there.
Yeah.
So it sounds like someone got arrested by the Gestapo, and then this other organization was basically saying, no, you can't take him. He's top secret. He's working on something with us called Gate or Gateway, which sounds like it was maybe technology that they didn't even understand what they'd made quite yet, but knew it might be required to lead to the bell or make the bell work.
Yeah.
Is that close?
Yeah. So my take on it is that I think it was just sort of an anecdote about an individual getting arrested by the Gestapo, and then someone above even them was like, no, you can't arrest this guy. He's too important. Mm-hmm. Which I think, you know, that speaks to how top secret this device was, because
you're above the secret police.
Yeah, the Gestapo, we don't need to go into details about them, but if you're someone who can't get arrested because you're too important and you know too much, I think that speaks volumes. Mm-hmm. And then kind of the second half of his answer, what I was getting from that is that even before, like at the very beginning of this, they made it the highest top secret clearance in all of Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. And he referenced reverse engineering.
Yes.
The thought that I was getting from that was that they had some sort of device or something, and they were trying to figure out how it works. Mm-hmm. And they knew that if we can mimic what this thing does, it will be decisive for the war.
Yeah.
And so they gave it that classification. They made it decisive for the war, top, top secret.
So you think that's the bell they're referencing, or technology they're trying to figure out how to harness for the bell?
I think what he is saying is they were aware of some sort of technology.
Yeah.
That they knew if we can harness that, we'll win the war.
Okay.
And so just right from the get-go, they made it ultra top secret.
Yeah.
Because they knew, I don't know how we're going to get this. I don't know how we're going to reverse engineer this. But if we do, mm-hmm. we win the war.
Yeah. So I wonder if it's something they made, like a little mini bell. The jingle bell, we'll call it.
The jingle bell. That was my take on his answer to that question.
Yeah, interesting.
The next thing, so we don't know much about the bell because it was ultra top secret. Right. And then I read another reason we don't know much about the bell is because everyone involved in the making of the bell and even the making of the facility that it was developed in was killed at the end of the war. They were so worried about any information about it getting out that the Nazis just eliminated everybody involved with the project. Wow. And so I asked him, is this true? What do you know about these claims? And so let's hear what he has to say and then come on back.
Yeah, let's give a listen.
Maybe you can verify this, but I heard somewhere that it was so top secret that pretty much anybody involved with the project was killed at the end of it. And the folks, I think it was slave labor that was used to build the facility around the Henge and the facility around the Henge, they were also killed after constructing it because the Nazis were so concerned about any information about this getting out. Is that accurate to say?
Yes, it is accurate. I mean, the fact that the middle, the German technical staff of the middle level and the last commander of the prisoners of the concentration camp, which assisted in this research, the fact that they were killed might have been justified by the fact that they might fall. It was in a situation where they might fall in the enemy's hands, in the hands of the Soviets. Perhaps there would be some logic, but in this. But on the other hand, it's not the only such a case in this story, because, for example, once I heard in a documentary about the Riesa complex in the Lower Silesia or Niederschlesien in German, that the entire design bureau of the organization Todt, which also was linked to this project, was killed. Namely, that they were invited for a kind of a party, which consisted of drinking vodka mostly, shortly before the capitulation, and the vodka was poisoned. And the only one who has survived didn't drink it because he had some, you know, ulcer or something like that, couldn't do it. And so he pretended that he died. That's one case. But another case is that in the Ludwikowice/Ludwigsdorf. Ludwigsdorf is a German name, which is a location where the Henge is. I had I knew, in fact, I do know still, a historian out there in this area, which is now part of Poland, did something strange. Namely, he has acquired names of the, because there is an there are organizations of Germans drove out of the eastern lost territories. It's I don't know how it is even in German, but there is a specific name for such an organization of former inhabitants of certain area in German. And he contacted families of the people who worked there, which were mostly engineers, technicians, and so on. And none of them has returned home after the war. They all disappeared. That's the second case. I mean, the third one after the commander that was evacuated. And another one, which would be fourth one, was that in the archives of the Gross-Rosen concentration camp, which was a kind of concentration camp consisting mostly of sub-camps servicing various armament undertakings in the vicinity of Lower Silesia. And it was the prisoners working there were subordinated to it. And in these archives were it is recorded that on one day, 20,000 prisoners of the concentration camp has disappeared. And the Polish prisoner who was a writer or the scribe or I don't know how to name it in this chancellery of the concentration camp mentioned to the SS officers that there must have been a mistake because the numbers are differing from the numbers from the previous day by 20,000 people. And they smiled and told him that, replied that, no, it's not a mistake.
Oh.
So perhaps even 20,000 prisoners have been, I mean, probably close underground, I suspect, because there was such an order by Himmler given shortly before the end of the war that all the concentration camp prisoners working on secret projects should be close underground.
Oh, that's terrible. Mm-hmm. Here.
Yes, it was revealed on the process of the commandant of the Mauthausen concentration camp in Nuremberg trials.
All right, so his answer to that question was way more detailed than I was expecting.
Yeah, and a lot darker and heavier in magnitude than.
Yes.
Well, he's also, it sounds like, not referencing just the bell, but pretty much any secret project Hitler was just like, get rid of them.
Yeah, like the whole Wunderwaffen program.
Yeah.
Just get rid of them. And he hit every level of person involved and talked about how the Nazis got rid of them. He talked about the top officials essentially were evacuated,
mm-hmm.
maybe to Argentina, like we talked about,
yeah.
maybe just to Berlin. He talked about mid-management folks. They all got invited to a party and they were poisoned. He talked about just the general workers and how their family said they just disappeared. They never came back. Nobody ever heard from them again.
Mm-hmm.
And then how the slave labor was just enclosed in the tunnels.
Yeah.
Because towards the end of the war, Hitler moved a lot of the manufacturing underground.
Mm.
The Nazis became like expert tunnel builders, and they had miles and miles and miles of underground tunnels and facilities and manufacturing complexes.
That seems so much more expensive to do it that way. Was that just to hide it from U.S. bombing?
You hide it from bombing, hide it from any kind of surveillance.
Right.
And so I think he said that there was just sort of an umbrella order given Haven to enclose slaves in the tunnels.
Yeah.
I don't doubt that the Nazis would have done any of those things.
No.
And that does add credence to why we don't know a whole lot about these secret things, because everybody involved at all levels was just eliminated.
Yep.
After that, I had one last question for him, because I think two questions ago, his answer, he referenced reverse engineering for how the Nazis got knowledge of the bell. And I asked him, do we have any concept of where this reverse engineering could have originated from?
Mm-hmm.
I'll go over why I asked that question and kind of analyze his answer to it a little bit after we listen to it.
Okay, sounds good.
Last question I got for you, I don't want to hold you up too long, is you mentioned a few minutes ago that your impression of the bell is that it was reverse engineered. Do you have any concept?
It might have been. It's only a suspicion. It's not okay. that something. Yeah.
So no idea of where it may have come from for them to reverse engineer it? Like where they would have gotten... hold of anything?
No, I don't know. There is a lot of legends about it, you know, various stories of a crashed flying craft and so on. But frankly saying, I have no information, strictly speaking, about it. I don't know.
Okay. Well, again, just thank you for your time. I really appreciate you jumping on here with me. It was nice talking with you.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So I asked that question because in the back of my mind, I was thinking, if this guy goes aliens, then this episode is about to take off in a third direction that I never expected.
It's always your final possibility, too, is that aliens did it.
Right? But he didn't, as you heard. Yeah. He didn't. He was very, very quick to say, I have no idea where this thing could have been from.
The soft illusion, I think you're right, is there. And he's kind of like, I don't know. But it could have been an experimental U.S. thing.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And then, you know, we had the blueprints over here too, or whatever it was that they found on our side, but it made it sound more like they were corroborating that Germany had something versus it being sourced from us, but maybe an allied force dropped it. It didn't work. They took it and tried to reverse engineer something inside of it.
Yeah, so short and sweet answer on that one. And he was very clear, you know, I don't know where this thing could have been reverse engineered from. And I don't want to speculate because there's just a lot of legends out there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that wrapped up my interview with him. Igor, if you're listening, I really appreciate the interview. It was great to get to chat with you.
Yeah, very cool. Appreciate the time for sure.
And so that kind of brings to a close the Nazi bell. And so, Evan? What do you think's going on with this thing? Do you think it was real? Do you think they ever created one? Do you think this is purely a work of fiction?
I told you before we started recording tonight that I listened on my commute to your guys' interview just to get at least a little up to speed, because as you guys have heard, it's just a lot to kind of dig through, especially the first time I'm hearing about it. I'm assuming you came in with at least a little bit of knowledge on it. So as I was on the metro, I'm like, what in the world? So it started off with me being like, I don't know where David found this guy. What is this about? And then the more I kept hearing, it's just clear he's got a very scientific background. There was so many different pieces of information connecting from so many different places in believable ways that as I was listening, it shifted to, I believe he believes what he's saying. I still just have no idea what these sources are. Like, I wish we could get our hands on some of this like physical documentation.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
I totally understand why we aren't going to get those emailed over. But all things said and done, I find him as like a believable source. The reverse engineering thing's an interesting approach. He seemed to kind of shut the door on it as far as that being an unknown.
Do you think the Nazis had an anti-gravitational propulsion device?
I do not. But what I do think is they were just throwing a lot of darts at the board, praying for one huge thing to stick that could really turn the tides of the war.
Okay.
So no idea was too crazy. nothing was too left field to try. And like I said, just some of the technology, I feel like it had to be some kind of weapon, right? Like, I don't know how else you turn the war, just making something anti-gravitational. I don't know what that does for you, unless it's to carry a payload, or maybe Hitler was just trying to make an escape pod to carry him up into space. That's another possibility I can come up with. He went up to go live on the moon.
Nazis on the moon.
At least one of them, yeah.
That, I think that's like a theory. Or there's a movie about that, I think. Moon Nazis.
We'll have to dig into that. Maybe we'll do a movie night on that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think for me, you know, the Nazis were a pretty evil bunch. All things kind of lead back to weaponry for me,
okay,
especially if you're trying to turn the war into your favor. So that's where I land on it, whether it was an atomic weapon or just some wild and out idea from either Hitler or a scientist that was just throwing something out there to, you know, not be one of the guys who got disappeared. Yeah, I think that's kind of where I land.
Okay.
But you're far more versed on this topic than me and got to interview the top expert on the Bell, it sounds like.
Yeah.
So where do you fall?
This one, I would say I feel more confident about my theory in this one than I usually do on these episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And so here's where I land on this one. If I were to put myself in the shoes of a top researcher, scientist, rocket engineer that is serving a megalomaniac who is becoming more delusional,
mm-hmm,
and I know that our enemies are closing in on us, like there's a limited amount of time left, I am going to be telling that leader whatever he wants to hear.
Yeah, for sure.
Because if I make him mad, he might just shoot me on the spot.
Yeah.
And so even if that becomes me making documentation, quote unquote, showing testing of a device that can win us the war, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And just show it to him, knowing full well that there's nothing here.
And he won't know the difference, basically, is what you're saying.
He won't know the difference.
Yeah.
We're talking about Hitler, right? He's not leaving the bunker. He's not going to like come to the facility and see it at this point in the war. So if we just keep feeding him information, it's going great over here. Yeah, you know, there was a bunch of radiation coming off of it, but we solved that problem.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, we just need that bomber from the other company so we can get the propulsion device in there. And, you know, then we'll win the war. I'm going to be telling him whatever he wants to hear.
Maybe the henge was an excuse to just pad on some time. Oh, it's so powerful, we have to enclose it in concrete.
Yeah, could be. If Igor was seeing these documents, they would read as though the Bell was developed.
Yeah, yeah.
It would read as though this was a real device that went through testing and a prototype was built, etc., etc.
Yeah.
But I think the more realistic case is that all of those documents were made just to save face in the face of a delusional megalomaniac.
Yeah, I like that theory. And so you think Nobel, basically, if anything, would be like a prop just to, if he shows up, be like, yeah, see, it's over there. It's, you
know, oh, yeah, but we don't have enough power to turn it on right now.
Spinning pieces of metal in it. And yeah, yeah. Delay tactic.
That is what's running through my head as the most likely explanation for this. Because like you said, Igor in the interview and in talking to him, he believes the things that he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get a sense of deception from him that he's trying to do this to get famous or known as the Nazi Bell guy or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think he believes what he's saying.
Yeah, I agree.
I think all the documentation may have been there, but it was all just sort of fabricated in order for the people working on the project to try to avoid the ultimate fate of being eliminated in one way or another, like he talked about.
So you mentioned the sun gun was real, right?
The thought of it was real.
Okay. They didn't
there's never any, as far as I know, they never started building it. They never tested anything. It didn't get past the blueprint stage.
Okay. And in theory, they destroyed everything they had anyway in the end to keep it out of other people's hands. So I guess who knows how far they got on most of that stuff anyway, unless there was some kind of testimony that leaked out after the fact in the Nuremberg trials or wherever else.
Yeah. And that's how we know about some of these other things that were being attempted to be built. The bomber that could fly to America and back,
right.
The ballistic missile submarine. You know, people testified to having worked on these projects.
Right.
But for whatever reason, the Bell was even more top secret than those things. And so just sort of almost everybody was eliminated that was involved with it at all.
Right. Well, great pick. I have to say, initially, I think you texted me like, yeah, the final episode's going to be on the Nazi bell. I was like, well, that's kind of a mid one to go out on. But this is clearly just a wild and out, really good one, I think, to go out on for wrapping out season one. So solid pick. Very cool. And thanks for reaching out to Igor. That's super cool. You got a chance to go straight to the source on that one.
Yeah, that's why this is episode 10, because I had a few different ideas for what I could do for the season finale. But then when he got back in touch with me, I was like, well, that settles
there
that. We're doing that. That's going to be our season finale.
Yeah, very cool.
And so now the reason everybody has actually been listening, we have a very exciting giveaway to talk about.
Yeah, we do.
Have you been considering tomorrow morning going on a walk?
I have. I just get so thirsty on those walks.
Really?
And I'm always so sober.
What could solve that?
I don't know. If only there was a singular device that not only could quench my thirst and sobriety, but also keep me visible to traffic.
And maybe in the off season, protect your water spigots?
It is a problem. They do freeze.
That's right, folks. We're giving away the Oddity Archive podcast branded water spigot covers / wine bottle holders.
High viz.
So if you've been craving a morning walk with a bottle of wine, if you've been needing a water spigot cover in the winter, now's your chance.
We've got you covered.
So full disclosure, I'm getting a couple of these things off of Amazon. I'm getting some custom stickers made. I'm going to slap them on there and, you know, enter the giveaway. See if you could possibly win one of these bad boys.
Great idea. Great giveaway.
And so to enter this giveaway, follow us on Instagram and share the post.
What's that handle?
Oddity Archive Podcast on Instagram. Follow us there and share the post of this episode. You want to give them any more hoops to jump through, Evan?
I mean, that's a good one. I don't want to give any more than one, but the prize matches the effort.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And then as a finishing touch, what should they comment on the post for this episode?
Spooky boys.
Oh, hashtag spooky boys. All right. Follow us on Instagram, share the post to your story, and comment hashtag spooky boys.
Yeah, love it.
And alternatively, if you don't want to do any of those things, if you email oddityarchivepodcast@gmail.com and you just put a subject line, give me that holder, with nothing in the body of the email, I'll put you in the giveaway too.
Ooh, or how about to repay you for all the nondescript photos you send me, they send you one nondescript photo.
There we go.
With no lower half male nudity. I cannot stress that enough.
Do that. And I'll put all five of our entries into a spinner online. And I think I bought a 2-pack of the spigot holders. So,
oh, 2 winners. Oh, even better.
Whoever wins, I'll get in touch with you and figure out how to get you this thing.
And then because we have your address, season 2, episode 1 will be at your house.
We're going to do a Ouija board session at your house.
And keep the wine cold. All right, we'll let you close it out because this thing has ultimately been your baby, your brainchild. But just want to say thank you to everybody. If we're a part of your commute, just your day, whatever, just thanks for including us in your day. Happy to be a part of it. And we're looking forward to another round of stories for season 2. But yeah, David, I'll let you close it out because ultimately this has been your germ of an idea from your front porch drinking some Mike's Hard Lemonades.
Yeah, good throwback. you know, like you just said, I am shocked that anybody has listened to any portion of this entire 10 episodes that we've made. So I genuinely, genuinely appreciate anybody that has listened to this. If you like what you're hearing, share it with one other person, introduce them to it, share an episode with them. If you feel so inclined, you can leave us a rating on whatever podcast app that you're using, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, whatever it might be. That does go a long way to help us. And as I said at the beginning, we'll see you for a couple bonus episodes and then season 2, episode 1 starting in, I think, September. So catch you then.
All right, guys. Till next time.
Bye.
Bye.
I am David Stuhldreher, creator and host. The show is edited by my co-host, Evan Miller. All original music created by Sean Bullock. You can follow him at Sean Bullock Video on Instagram. All original artwork done by Tanis. Follow her at Tanis Tattoos on Instagram as well. Thank you for listening.